March, listen to the stories of 11 East Central Illinois residents interviewed by students at University High School in Urbana. It's In the Wake of Brown, Stories of Integration and Struggle, August 11th at 6 p.m. here on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois.
Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s and south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the mid-80s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the evening, the low in the upper 50s with west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Today's Keepin' the Faith with Steve Shoemaker has been pre-recorded, so no phone calls can be taken. Steve's guest was Danny Otto, and the topic, Amish relief. It's 5 p.m. The program will begin following news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A U.S.-appointed judge in Iraq has issued arrest warrants for former governing council member Ahmed Chalabi and his nephew. Chalabi, who was once a favorite of Pentagon officials, is calling the counterfeiting charges against him outrageous. His nephew, Salem Chalabi, heads the tribunal that will try Saddam Hussein. Salem Chalabi faces murder charges. For a fourth straight day, U.S. Marines and Iraqi security forces have clashed with militia loyal to radical Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr in Najaf. NPR's Ivan Watson has more.
Just hours after Iraq's prime minister made a quick and unexpected visit to the war-torn city, fierce fighting erupted in central Najaf. From a nearby vantage point, an Iraqi employee for NPR reported American fixed-wing aircraft and helicopters circling overhead. Machine gun fire rattled through Najaf's medieval streets. An American sniper could be seen perched on a rooftop as black-masked Sadr fighters moved in the distance. During his brief visit, Iraqi Prime Minister Iyad Alawi called these gunmen outlaws and urged them to lay down their weapons. Ivan Watson, NPR News, Baghdad.
The president of the International Olympic Committee says American athletes suspected of using performance-enhancing drugs will not be banned from this summer Olympic Games unless there has been proof of drug use. NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Athens.
Alleged drug use by American athletes was a major issue at the last summer games, and it popped up again at the first news conference in Athens with International Olympic Committee President Jacques Roga.
We know that there is a question mark on certain athletes, but the disciplinary procedure of these athletes has not led to a proof of guilt. And as long as there is no proof of guilt, the athletes are eligible.
American track star Marion Jones is suspected of doping, which she strenuously denies. She's expected to compete in Athens.
Do I believe that these cases will tarnish the games? No. I believe the games are far too strong for that.
Several American athletes also accused of doping failed to qualify for the 2004 games. Howard Berkus, NPR News, Athens.
Conservative political commentator Alan Keyes has decided to run as the GOP candidate for U.S. Senate in Illinois. The two-time presidential hopeful will face one of the rising stars of the Democratic Party, Barack Obama, and Keyes' candidacy sets up the first U.S. Senate contest ever with African Americans representing both major parties. Keyes says he knows he faces an uphill fight.
So I'm not going to stand here and with tremendous ease promise you a victory. But I'll tell you what I will promise. I will promise you a fight!
Keyes does not live in Illinois, and in the past he has criticized political candidates who run for office in states where they do not have residency. This is NPR News from Washington.
The NPR shop offers Driveway Moments, a 2-CD collection of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
This is Keepin' the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Our guest today on Keepin' the Faith is Danny Otto, and we're talking about the Amish and the Mennonites. And we'll be talking specifically about a relief sale that they have coming up here later in the month. But welcome, Danny. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Now, you yourself are Mennonite. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Tell us the difference.
Well, the Mennonites and the Amish have a common origin in the Reformation in the 16th century. And the direction they took was a little bit different than the mainstream Lutheran Protestant direction. They tended to be very practically oriented, and they begin the reading of the Bible with the Sermon on the Mount. And so following the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount are sort of a hallmark of the Amish and Mennonite tradition, and that would include a commitment to caring for other people, taking seriously the admonition that it's not those who say, Lord, Lord, but those who visit the sick and the afflicted and the widows.
Now, for some of our listeners who may not know their Bible as well as you do, the Sermon on the Mount is found in the Gospel of Matthew, chapters 5, 6, and 7, I guess, would be typically what would be understood as that. And here Jesus is talking, according to Matthew, who's apparently pulled a bunch of the sayings together that we find in other Gospels spread out other places, into one sort of big sermon or lecture or teaching of Jesus. Now, why did the Amish start there? Why did they pick those three verses out of all the New Testament or all the Bible?
That's not easy to answer because one can't get back into the skin and the motivation of the people, 500 years ago. But there seems to be a common response of people who are persecuted, and this also preceded the Amish and the Mennonites in the 16th century, so the Waldensians and people earlier on. When the power of the official church and the state came down on them, the response was to say, you ought not to do that because Jesus said, turn the other cheek. Jesus said, and so these sorts of admonitions that come from the Sermon on the Mount become a kind of protective mechanism, at least historically, to tell the powers that be that they're not behaving according to the teachings of Jesus.
Now, since this is kind of an unusual Keeping the Faith program in that we are not taking telephone calls this hour because we're needing to pre-record it because of your schedule and mine, I need to try to ask all the questions that callers would ask.
Fine.
And so let me start with one that someone might ask, which is, the Sermon on the Mount seems to be such an impossible standard. It seems to call for perfection. We're supposed to be peacemakers. We're supposed to turn the other cheek. We're supposed to love our enemies. We're not only not supposed to murder. We're not supposed to hate. We're not supposed to lust. How can this possibly be a model for real human beings?
It does seem to be an impossible model, and practically speaking, it is. But the insistence has been that that is still meant to be a serious goal to aspire to, so that Mennonites and Amish have rejected the traditional ways of explaining away those hard teachings by saying it really wasn't intended to be an ethic for this life. It was a description of how life might be in heaven.
Some people have said that, and the Amish say no.
No. Right. This is still...
We're to do this.
we're to aspire to this. It's a serious call. And so there's a rejection of any justification of war, for example. And even some practical things such as, so one of the teachings in the Sermon on the Mount is that one ought not to swear oaths. And so, the refusal to swear oaths. And if you are ever called in a circumstance where you would be asked to swear an oath, the response is, I will affirm to tell the truth, but they would take seriously, or we take seriously, that your yes should be yes and your no should be no, and that's the end of it.
Do the Amish and Mennonite say the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag?
That's an awkward thing. Mm-hmm. Because it happens in public schools,
yes,
and so on. And so most parents would encourage their children not to do it. Mm-hmm. But we know how tough it is to be a young child in that circumstance.
Yes.
And my own children, in recent years, the importance of the pledge has sort of been reemphasized. And my own children went through several years where it was a big thing for them not to do it, and then gradually it was sort of shrugged off, and it didn't seem to be as important. Mm-hmm. But I can recall my son, who's now 18, I think he quite accurately described the pledge as a kind of prayer. And he said, I feel so stupid praying to that piece of cloth.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a very perceptive comment mm-hmm. for a little tyke who was about six at the time.
Many on the right wing of Christianity would see that saying the Pledge of Allegiance and other things like that, emphasizing the under God part of it, are sort of a test to see if one is truly patriotic and truly Christian. And yet here are the Amish and Mennonite who would be saying, wait a minute, let's reexamine that.
Well, the tradition has been that we see our allegiance not to any land mm-hmm. or any person or any government here, but to God alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has been a migratory tradition of the Amish and Mennonites. And if you live in a land where politically it's not hospitable to your beliefs, then you pick up and move to someplace that is hospitable.
Mm-hmm.
And so there have been Mennonite and Amish migrations from Holland to North Germany to Russia and then to Kansas yeah. and the Great Plains.
And Canada.
And, you know, Amish migrations. And some of this was powered in the 17th and 18th century when the European countries needed to have mass conscription to keep their war going.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that time, you know, it became hospitable to pick up and move to North America. But at the time of the American Revolution, it was hard to figure out what the stance of the Amish should be who were living in Pennsylvania at the time, because there was a lot of pressure to be supportive of the revolutionary government. And some people felt like King George had done them no harm and King George was allowing them to live in peace.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of them, as a matter of conscience, picked up and moved to Ontario
mm-hmm.
because they didn't want to be seen as being rebellious, not out of loyalty to the crown, but out of a concern that they did not want to be associated with the revolution itself.
Now, how do Amish and Mennonite today deal with the government in the United States and state governments that say your kids should have certain kinds of schooling and county governments that say there are certain rules about zoning and health codes and things like that? How do people with this kind of a tradition respond to all that?
Well, it's very strong belief that one ought to obey the powers that be unless the laws conflict with the teaching of the gospel, so that you obey zoning laws and tax laws and everything else. The only time one would be disobedient is if it's a matter of conscience. There was a Supreme Court ruling in the 1950s that allowed the Amish to have their own schools, so they're exempted from the requirement that their children attend public schools that are certified by the state. And so in the Arthur community, there's been a flourishing school movement there, and I think they must have 21 or 22 rural schools educating their own children, and they do quite a good job.
And for listeners beyond the Champaign-Urbana area in Indiana and places farther away, the Arthur community is about how far from Champaign?
It's about 30 miles straight south.
Okay.
Yeah, in Douglas County.
And it's how large of a Amish community is centered around Arthur?
Well, the Amish tend to have larger families, you know, five or six children, and so it's growing very rapidly. One can't keep up. And the community is divided into church districts based on geography. And I think right now there are 26 districts, and each one would probably have about 120 to 150 in a district. So
people or families?
People, individuals,
okay.
Yeah, parents and children.
Uh-huh.
They need to keep the size at about that range because the Amish worship in homes. They don't have meeting houses.
Mm-hmm.
And so practically speaking, a large congregation doesn't work very well.
Mm-hmm.
And so when a district gets too large, they simply divide it geographically and they choose new leadership for the new district and go on.
Let me reintroduce our guest on Keeping the Faith this afternoon. We're talking with Danny Otto about Amish and the Mennonites and specifically a relief sale that's coming up soon. Tell us when that's going to be.
The Arthur Mennonite Relief Sale will be August 27th and 28th, just on the south edge of Arthur, Illinois. there will be signage there indicating the location. And this is the 43rd annual sale for World Relief.
Now, what do you mean it's for World Relief?
If I could quickly sketch out how these sales came to be.
Sure.
The Amish and Mennonites were known to be a very tight ethnic group and Germanic and so on. And they had a tradition of looking out for each other within the community, but they didn't have a very intense involvement or engagement with the broader world. At the time of the Russian Revolution, Mennonites in North America became aware that Mennonites in the Soviet Union were suffering, and this was during the period of famine in 1919, 1920, 1921. And so they did what practical rural people would do, is they organized food shipments and tractor shipments and farm equipment and so on informally to help out the Mennonites there. And out of that effort to help other Mennonites began the tradition that there are other people who are not Mennonites who are also in dire straits who need help. And so Mennonite Central Committee was organized as a central coordinating committee of all of the Mennonite churches and Amish churches in North America to do relief and development work. And then in the period after World War II, because Mennonites and Amish were non-resistant, many of them spent the war period working in mental health hospitals and doing other sorts of relief work here in North America.
Along with other pacifists.
Along with other pacifists, Quakers and brethren and so mm-hmm. on. After that, there became a kind of global vision of what the Mennonite Church ought to be doing to help others. And so now it has volunteers. Mennonite Central Committee has volunteers in about 50 countries around the world, 750 people from North America who are there doing relief and development work. My own family's been quite involved in that. I have a brother who, in the 90s, during the genocide in Rwanda, went there as an MCC staffer to help refugees.
Mennonite Central Committee.
Mennonite Central Committee, yes. Mm-hmm. And then in recent years has been in the Balkans working in Serbia and Croatia and so on.
Now the public is invited to the Arthur Mennonite Relief Sale, August 27 and 28. It starts Friday afternoon at 4:30 with a barbecue, and there's an auction at 6 as it continues Saturday from 8 o'clock. Pancake and sausage at 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock in the morning, I see, earlier even. And barbecue chicken at noon on Saturday the 28th. Butterfly pork chops. The Amish eat well, don't they?
The Amish eat well. There will be lots of food there. And there are things that are long-established traditions. The pancakes and sausage on Saturday morning. I don't think this brochure highlights it, but we have people who come from many miles for the donuts.
The homemade yeast donuts.
The homemade yeast donuts, and you know, they're made from scratch. And there's a committee that starts at about noon on Friday, so there are some ready by 4:30, and some people come in about 2 o'clock in the morning so that at 6 o'clock the donut line can be served. This event got started, and it's part of a network. There are 46 of these auctions across North America.
I've been to the one in Iowa.
That's a large auction. Mm-hmm. And the proceeds from these auctions goes for world relief projects. And the idea is that these local communities, which tend to be rural, have, you know, certain sorts of skills and so on, but you might not know much about what to do to help someone in Bangladesh or Pakistan. But what one can do is use the skills you have in quilting and baking and furniture making and so on, and have an event like this, invite the public in, sell your items, and then use the proceeds of that to help people in other parts of the world. So on the one hand, it's very ethnic in the sense that it reflects the local Amish and Mennonite community, but the proceeds, the intent of the proceeds is globally oriented.
Tell us some of the things that will be sold and auctioned.
Well, we have the Arthur community is known for its furniture, so we have a lot of furniture items that are locally made, and ranging from small knickknacks that are $15 or $20 to we have a long tradition of a facsimile of the standard edition U.S. Postmaster's roll-top desk, an oak roll-top desk, and that's about a $2,500 to $3,500 item. And we have quilts, and one of the things that we're featuring this year, we have a quilt from what we were referring to as the Will Schrock family. A woman, Ella Schrock, started making a quilt every year for this sale 30 years ago, and now it's into the fourth generation. Wow. She's deceased. Huh. And her daughters and granddaughters and great-granddaughters are now working on this. And so that's going to be one of the special items this year.
Now, is it only are things only sold at auction, or can are some things just a fixed price?
We do have some things at fixed price. Many of the people here in Champaign-Urbana are familiar with 10,000 Villages store here, which is that's a branch of Mennonite Central Committee. And so they will have inventory there that will be sold at a fixed price. And we also have a silent auction bid board with items on it, and you can come and place a bid and raise it, and you know, until 2 o'clock when the top bid gets it. But most of the items are sold across the auction ring. And that, of course, if people enjoy auctions, is a lot of fun. It can be a little confusing to newcomers, but we have a good team of auctioneers and people who help those who aren't familiar with the process
to learn how to do it.
Yeah.
And you can always slip off and have the strawberries and ice cream and lemon shake-ups and the homemade pies and the hot pretzels and the fruit yogurt cups.
That was added this past year. We had some people say, you know, your food here is great, but many of us
are dieting.
are dieting. And so I organized my son and some of his friends from the youth group to do yogurt fruit cups. And so we have raspberries and peaches and fruit, and we put it into a cup of fruit parfait.
But wouldn't the Amish and Mennonite also appreciate the notion of feasting one day and then fasting the next to make up for it?
That's right. So, you know, most of the people that are there work very hard other days, and so to overindulge a bit isn't going to make much difference. But
right. And, of course, following the Sermon on the Mount where we began this program, the Amish who would be fasting would not be letting anyone know.
That's true.
Because that part of the Bible says, don't keep it a secret.
Yeah.
We're talking with Danny Otto here on Keeping the Faith, and we're not taking telephone calls today. This is an unusual program because we're pre-recording this because of Professor Otto's schedule and mine. Let's let people know a little bit about your background. You do teach philosophy, of all things, at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. How long have you been doing that?
Since 1993.
How did you get interested in philosophy?
Well, that baffles a lot of people, including myself. My own background is my parents were Old Order Amish until I was four, and they moved and joined the Mennonite Church, which allows a few more things, you know, electricity and cars and so on. But my own parents, of course, never went beyond an eighth grade, and I come from a family of nine children, and seven of us have advanced degrees in one thing or another.
Wow.
So my parents had a love of learning, and they would go to auctions and come home with a box of books, used books, and we would devour them. And when I was 21, several years after high school, I worked locally at several jobs. I decided to go to university, and philosophy took a hold of me.
Where did you go?
Illinois State for my undergraduate, and then Notre Dame and University of Toronto for graduate study.
What advanced degrees do you have?
Master's.
Uh-huh.
From both Notre Dame and University of Toronto.
In philosophy?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So it's one of those things that people wonder how someone from a practical background, rural background, gets interested in these things. And you know, if you look back at the history of philosophy, Thales, for example, pre-Socratic Greek philosopher, people made fun of him because he was always speculating on things that they weren't practical. But he used his knowledge to do a little bit of meteorology and realized they were going to have a bumper crop in olives and cornered the market on olive presses and got rich. And he said, you know, here I could have made a lot of money if that had been my goal in life, and now I'm going to go back and do philosophy. So my Amish relatives understand that, and I have interesting conversations with them. They do like to ask me a lot of questions about what it is that I'm doing and reading and so on.
And how do you correlate the philosophy from the pre-Socratics, what, 400 years before Jesus, to your theology and your belief as a Mennonite about the Christian faith?
Well, I don't correlate it in the sense of trying to make some sort of unity out of it. My approach to philosophy is more, I don't have any strong philosophical commitments in terms of tying into one school or the other. I'm interested in the flow of ideas and the interrelationship, the growth of ideas, so that I don't have any program to try to pull Plato and my Amish and Mennonite background together. Mm. It's not that important to me.
I see. So it's more a matter of curiosity, interest, but your basic commitment, I suppose we should say, is
right. I mean, it's a matter of curiosity for me. I'm very fascinated in how various philosophical ideas, you know, grow and permutate from one thing to another. Mm. But I don't have any sense of urgency to come up with a philosophical framework that will support my ethical and religious ideas.
And so when you run across things like the just war teachings of certain branches of Christianity, how do you as a Mennonite and a philosopher deal with those kind of arguments?
Well, I think from a philosophical perspective, even if one doesn't come at it from an Amish or Mennonite background, there are problems with the theory, so one can approach it from a logical perspective. Look at the internal coherency of it. One can approach it from a practical perspective, which is probably more persuasive to someone like myself, and reach the viewpoint that actually the Catholic bishops did about 15 years ago, that practically speaking, there is no such thing as a just war now that can meet the criteria of protecting non-combatants, the various criteria that they check through. So for me to study that helps me in my conversations with people who believe in the just war theory, because I can raise some questions to sort of cause them to think about the coherency of the theory itself.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask another question our callers might ask if they had the opportunity today, and that is about the Amish and Mennonite commitment to pacifism. What about post 9/11? When a community is attacked, if instead of planes going into the World Trade Center in urban New York, what if they'd gone into downtown Arthur? How would the Amish and Mennonites respond to a direct attack by a group, at least some of whom were motivated by their religious beliefs?
Well, the primary response would be one of grief and mm-hmm. sadness. Mm-hmm. But then there would be a very strong sense that retaliation is not called for, mm-hmm. and retaliation doesn't solve the problem. Nothing is to be gained by retaliation. I think the more interesting component of the 9/11 scenario is, what if you were Amish or Mennonite and on the plane that ultimately went down in Pennsylvania?
And would you use force to try to...
You know, there the attempt to use non-lethal force to actually take over the plane mm-hmm. and crash it, taking your own life as a way of saving more lives, I think probably, you know, that's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. I'm very sympathetic to the people who took that action.
Sure.
You know, I'm not in that situation. I don't know if I could do it. But one of the iconic figures is Dirk Willems, who was a Dutch Mennonite at a time when it was illegal to be a Mennonite, mm-hmm. and he was being pursued by the authorities and was going to be executed. They, you know, did various things, burned them at the stake. He was going to be killed. Mm-hmm. And it was in the wintertime, and as he was crossing a canal, his pursuer fell through the ice. And he was on the other side. Yeah. So what do you do? Well, he turned around and rescued his pursuer, who then arrested him, and he was burned at the stake. So that is a story that every Amish and Mennonite child knows.
Huh.
And so there's all sorts of interesting lessons that one can learn out of that, and it becomes difficult to know exactly how one would transpose that to every current situation. Mm-hmm. But the idea that even if someone is pursuing you with the intent to do evil, that you still recognize their humanity is at least a core lesson out of that.
Hmm. We're about halfway through our program today on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. Our guest today is Danny Otto, and we'll be talking with him a bit more about the Amish and Mennonite relief sale and about the beliefs and practices of the Amish and Mennonites in this part of central Illinois and Indiana and other places around the world. Our guest next week on Keeping the Faith is Father Paul Pluth, who will be talking about Mary in church life. That's August 15. On August 22nd, our guests will be Joel and Barry Schweitzer. We'll be talking about Jewish education. And then August 28th, another Mennonite, Larry Wilson, will be our guest talking about current faith and life. So we have some interesting guests ahead on Keeping the Faith. These programs are sponsored in part by the University YMCA, where I'm the executive director. The University Y at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign is the oldest religious institution at the university. It was started by students back in 1873. And so for the past 131 years, the Y has been helping develop student leaders by providing opportunities for social action and community service. One of the Big Y events will be our big dump and run sale, where we recycle many items that have been donated to the Y, starting with when students moved out in the spring and as well over the summer, and community people who've donated things. We have furniture and electronics and kitchenware and housewares and clothes and TVs and all sorts of things, even cars that have been donated that we'll be selling. It happens to be on the same day as the Amish Relief Sale, but we start a little earlier. We start on the 25th of August, 25th, 26th, 27th, and 28th at the Stock Pavilion on Pennsylvania Avenue in Champaign-Urbana. And folks are welcome to come to this sale and buy things very inexpensively. And then you can head down to Arthur and enjoy the food and auction at the Mennonite Relief Sale. You can drive down there in one of the cars you buy cheap at the Y. let's see. Let me take one more minute at this point, halfway through the program, to give our guest a little chance to breathe without having to talk. I'd like to read one more poem, as I've been reading for several weeks, from a book by Jean Murray Walker, published by the University of Illinois Press, as part of their Illinois Poetry Series, edited by Lawrence Lieberman, Professor Lieberman at the university. And as part of this series, the new book by Jeannie Murray Walker, is called A Deed to the Light. And here's a poem that was first published in the journal Spirituality and Health. And it speaks about a mother's relationship with a grown son, soon to go off to college, as the family itself is moving from the childhood home. And the title of the poem is called Making the Move. We are sitting on the floor, sorting your rock collection, sending the granite back to the earth, the mica schist to the box marked save. I love the geode. Jack, I say, and mention its shine. You hold it in your palm, deciding. Outside it's raining, proof that no sooner do you get to know the sky, then it moves on. Tomorrow the moving van arrives. Your father and I have signed the paper. This is the last day I will touch the door where I turned so many times to feed you and meet myself turning. But your voice is changing. You throw me a glance. This nostalgia's prehistoric. You turn the geode over. What if we are nothing, I wonder, but the stones we choose to keep? Jack, I say, this time for everything we dare not throw away, you have tossed the Odyssey aside. I think of the man who never stopped moving and called it 20 years of life, remembering the chapter where he talks to his heart, how he says, old friend, you who have gone everywhere with me, when the testing comes, do not burst. He knew how little he could carry in his knapsack and still call it home. He would have kept this, I think, the split geode, gleaming like 100 amethysts. As you toss it in the garbage, I don't even move to save it. The old stalwart rock, my heart, my heart. A poem by Jean Murray Walker called Making the Move, first published in the journal Spirituality and Health, collected in her recent 2004 book, A Deed to the Light, published by the University of Illinois Press, read by permission of the author and the U of I Press. Well, we were talking with our guest Danny Otto about how often the Amish and Mennonites have moved and had those kind of experiences with their families as they faced religious persecution on several continents. How have the Amish and Mennonites been treated in central Illinois and Indiana?
I think they would consider they've been treated very well, and they feel welcome in their communities and are doing very well. And, you know, I've talked a little bit about the ideals of the Amish and Mennonites, but we're only human, and when we're successful, I mean, as a people who believe in honesty and hard work and so on, it's inevitable that you accumulate worldly possessions and so on, and that makes it a little harder to say, you know, well, it's time for me to pick up and move.
That's right.
And I myself marvel at how strong I still do find that attitude among the Amish, my Amish relatives and so on, that some of them have very successful businesses, and they will get the impulse that there might be a new community starting someplace, that they ought to go and be a part of that, and they'll walk away from considerable time and investment to do that. And one thing that really stands out in my mind, 10, 12 years ago, the state of Illinois bought an abandoned railroad right-of-way to do a rails-to-trails bike conversion. And it was a new idea at that time, and the local Farm Bureau was organizing against it, and actually went and induced a number of the Amish ministers to write a letter opposing it because it was going to be disruptive, that the argument was. Mm-hmm. And it was ironic because the Amish ride bicycles
sure
everywhere. And I agreed to take a representative from Springfield from the Department of Natural Resources around to meet some of these ministers to talk about this a bit more. And we went to one minister, and he nearly ran out of his house to greet us, and he was so glad I brought him. He apologized for signing that letter. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, you have certain responsibilities as the government to do what you think is best for the people of Illinois. And he said, I live a quarter of a mile from the railroad, and if I can't live with what happens there, you know, I'll move. Huh. But you have a job to do, and I shouldn't tell you how to do it.
Interesting.
And you don't run into that very often.
Sure.
The impulse would be to stand and fight.
In terms of your moving, how have you chosen to move? You've been living in Arcola, is that right?
Yes, or in rural Arcola.
Rural Arcola.
Yeah, I've been farming there and living on a family farm
since
graduate
school.
As well as teaching.
All right.
I turned 50 a year ago, and I feel, my wife and I feel like we have another 15, maybe if we're lucky, 20 good years left. And I never intended when I completed my graduate studies at University of Toronto to return to Arcola and spend the rest of my life there. The farming sort of crept up on us, and in recent years I've been too busy with farming and my involvement with the relief sale and other sort of boards that I'm on. So we decided to wipe the slate clean, and so we're moving to Urbana and hope to move on. One of my goals in life is to serve abroad as a volunteer with Mennonite Central Committee in some foreign country. And so, you know, that could happen sooner rather than later, depending on the opportunities that arise.
And your wife works with special education children, and so she could do that in another country
as well.
That's right,
yes.
Mm-hmm. Did any of your brothers or sisters, you said you came from a family of nine, did any of them go back to the old order Amish way of life as opposed to Mennonite?
No. None of my family, my immediate family is. Uh-huh. Probably 60% of my relatives on each side of the family are still older Amish.
Do you ever regret that your parents, in making that move from the old order Amish to the more accepting of many modern conveniences and distractions and things with the Mennonites, do you ever wish you were living yourself that simpler life?
Not seriously. I mean, I have strong connections to that life and you know, my family and relatives there. But it's one of those things that it's very, very difficult to adopt that way of life if you weren't raised that mm-hmm. way. And there's some very attractive features of that that I enjoy my involvement because the importance of community and family and mutual aid and so on are messages that we don't get very strongly from other parts of our society. And so I appreciate the challenge they present to me, but it wouldn't be a serious option for me to change my life at this point.
Now, many people across the United States these days are learning a little bit about the Amish, maybe something very wrong, from this new reality television show where, is it two Amish teenagers are put in a house with a bunch of other teenagers with very different lifestyles and are somehow being forced to live together for a while? Have you heard about this?
I've read about it. That's all I know is what I've read. But I think I can comment on it. Friends of the Amish, I think, are more upset with this than the Amish themselves because the Amish don't watch TV.
Sure.
And so and they sort of expect the worst from Hollywood and TV, so they're not surprised if they get it.
Right.
And they, of course, would be disappointed in these young people. I don't know. I think there might be four or six.
Are there that many? Okay.
And they would be 19 or 20, 21 years uh-huh. old. But
so these are young people who have grown up in an Amish home and environment, and typically they are encouraged to go out to the wider world and then come back of their own free will. Is that my understanding?
It's a little more nuanced than that.
I'm sure.
There's a period of time. One of the distinctives between the Amish and Mennonites and the mainstream of the Reformation or the Roman Catholic Church is the rejection of infant baptism because they said faith is an act of the will and an infant does not yet have that will. And so to baptize an infant isn't meaningful. You're baptized as an adult when you understand what it is that you're being baptized into. So the Amish, strictly speaking, these young people are not seen by the Amish community as Amish because they have never joined the church.
They've not chosen to be baptized.
They've not chosen to be baptized.
Okay.
And so they are very, very serious that a person understand what it is that they're doing when they're baptized. And so there is a tradition that after the age of 16, young people are on a looser leash for a number of years. And the extremes of that can involve, you know, activities that certainly the parents in the community frown upon. But the idea is that if they do come back from that, they understand exactly what it is that they're committing themselves to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sociologists study this and they're quite fascinated because it seems to work. They have a much higher retention rate of children who were raised in an Amish home who stay Amish than virtually any other denomination. So,
how do Mennonites do?
Mennonites don't do nearly as well.
Too much freedom too early.
I think it's that. And Mennonites, of course, have lost because we're part of the mobile society. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't visit each other as much. We mm-hmm. don't have people in and out of our homes. They've lost a lot of the strengths of the Amish way of life that are forced upon you if you don't have the conveniences of modern transportation and so on. Mm. So,
and Presbyterians are getting fewer each year because our children, we encourage them to be such free thinkers that they completely often leave the faith of the home. We're talking with Danny Otto about the Amish and the Mennonite, and particularly about the relief sale. And on this edition of Keeping the Faith, we're not having any phone calls because we're pre-recording this because of our guest schedule and mine. But let's talk a little bit more about the relief sale. Again, it's August 27 and 28 at Otto Center in Arthur, Illinois. Now, Otto Center, that's your last name. What's the connection?
In the 19th century, when they established rural schools, they would take it out of the corner of someone's 160-acre, their quarter section, and oftentimes the school was then named after the owner who donated the land. So my ancestor, Daniel Otto, came from Pennsylvania in 1865, and the school, public school, was built. It was a public school at that time. It was built on the corner of his land. It was known as the Otto School. Then when consolidation occurred and the school was shut down by the public school system, some people bought this property and now have a very, very extensive facility there that can accommodate several thousand people. And it continues to be known as the Otto Center.
And folks who'd like to come to the sale can go down I-57 to Route 133 over to Arthur and find the Otto Center. There'll be all sorts of signs.
There'll be signage there, and it's a very small community.
We could joke and say, follow the closest horse and buggy.
Probably that would be safe.
But oddly, on this brochure about the local handicrafts are going to be sold, the silent auction, the children's auction, there's an email address. There's a phone number. There's a web. Is this a website?
It's a website on PrairieNet. Yes. We try to reach out to our constituency, which you know tends to be non-Amish.
Right.
So the people hosting the sale, and I want to emphasize this, is the Amish and Mennonite community. But people are welcome there, regardless of their religious faith or
sure.
total lack thereof. And
sure.
and we have a very eclectic group of people show up, coming from as far away as Florida and Arizona every year for this event.
Let me give the information for folks who might like to learn more about the sale. A telephone number, 217-543-3307. Let me repeat that, 217-543-3307. There's an email address, Beachy, B-E-A-C-H-E-Y, at consolidated.net. And there's a website at www.prairienet.org/Arthur Relief Sale, all smashed together as one word. prairienet.org/Arthur Relief Sale, R-E-L-I-E-F. So what would people find when they get there? There's a place to park cars as well as buggies.
A place what? To park cars and buggies. There's an entrance, a greeting center where they can register for the auction. We use buyer's numbers because the auctioneers don't know the people that are there. There are booths selling food items to be consumed, right? Homemade ice cream, pies, lemonade shake-ups, popcorn, and then the main meals, which Friday evening is pork. Saturday noon is barbecued chicken. Saturday morning is pancakes and sausage. We have a book table. We have you had asked earlier whether there's anything there simply for a fixed price. We do have local-made handicrafts that are sold throughout the auction at a fixed price, and then at the end, what's left over is sold across the auction ring. It's a lot of fun. I have been involved. I've been on the board of this sale since 1991, I believe. I've lost track myself. We have people who get started coming, and they plan their family vacations around it. Mm. So people come with their campers and so on several days in advance. And it takes on a bit of a festive atmosphere, almost like a reunion. It's a very welcoming community. It it's probably one of the smaller sales viewed nationally compared to Iowa or Wichita, Kansas or northern Indiana. So we'll have several thousand people there. Last year, our revenue was $130,000.
Wow.
Which, you know, is significant for a small community. Mm-hmm. But it's a very welcoming group of people there, and we have lots of people who have struck up friendships and so on, and they come back every year because of that.
For people who come from different religious traditions or have no religious background at all, are they going when they encounter someone from the Amish community, how do they talk with someone whose dress is so different, whose way of life is so different? How do you start up a conversation?
The Amish are very open people, and probably the most open about their way of life and knowledgeable about their way of life of any religious group I've come into contact with. So they're very comfortable talking about it. And if you don't treat them as a museum piece or an object of curiosity, just treat them as another human being and engage in conversation, you'll be very welcome.
But surely someone from the English, some little kid is going to point to a hat or a bonnet and say, Mommy, why is she wearing that?
They won't be shocked. They're accustomed to that, and they're respectful. We do ask people to be respectful in terms of photographing people and people's faces. The Amish are aware that when they're in public, people will be photographing and so on, but as long as someone isn't obviously trying to do a personal photo of someone, they're very tolerant of that and understanding.
And if people want to learn more about the Amish, how can they do that?
In Arcola, which is the town just east of Arthur, the Illinois Amish Interpretive Center does an excellent job of laying out the basics of the Amish religion and tradition and the origins of the local community there. And that has regular hours during the summertime, I think from 10 until 6.
And even at other times than the Amish relief sale, the Amish welcome visitors to come to Arcola and Arthur and also to go to the typical hardware stores and grocery stores run by the Amish for the Amish and walk the aisles and pick out things that are interesting. The harness shops, there's some fascinating things to see.
Yeah, there are great stores there. And, you know, we have a lot of people who come there to do their regular shopping. Mm-hmm. There's a great little grocery store that is known as Country Salvage Store. And it's now a full-line grocery, but originally it was sort of a scratch-and-dent store. And it probably does as much volume as a regular commercial store, and people come from all over the place because they buy their items from wholesalers, and there's always surprises that you don't expect. And so one can come and find gourmet cheeses, Camembert and Brie cheese that is just ready to be eaten. And one can even get Starbucks coffee there at the little Amish grocery store.
August 27 and 28 in Arthur, Illinois, the Arthur Mennonite Relief Sale. Our guest is Danny Otto. Danny, what do you look most forward to at the sale in terms of either food or things to look forward to buy? I know it's a lot of work for you since you're on the committee, but is there some parts that are still fun for you?
Well, I enjoy the food, but I guess from my hat as chairman of the event, you know, the next 27 days, I wake up in the middle of the night a lot in a cold sweat wondering whether everything is going to come together. But one of the things that I really enjoy about the sale is the cooperative group of volunteers. So we have over 20 committees that are responsible for various aspects, and I have very little direct contact with each of these. I trust that they're going to do what they're responsible for doing, and indeed they do. So on the sale day, it's always inspiring to see all of these people materialize, and, you know, literally there are hundreds of people involved in bringing this together, and everything comes together and gets done. And then at the end of the sale, you know, one shouldn't say one looks forward to the end, but I'm tired by 3:30, 4 o'clock Saturday afternoon. And we have people, there's a person from Springfield, and I know his face, I don't know his name, But about 15 minutes before the sale is over, he starts folding up the folding chairs, and other people pick up the cue from him. And usually an hour and a half after the sale is over, I can go home.
Wow.
And everything is put away.
There's been that much help.
The people stay behind, even those who aren't formally affiliated or who are visiting from other states, they stay. Everything is put away, and we go home, and it's Saturday night, and the next day is Sunday, and we all rejoice.
Our last 30 seconds, what is there for children?
We have a tent with children's activities. We have an auction for children with under parent supervision. They assemble school kits that are sent to refugee children around the world, little drawstring bags with crayons and pencils and so on. They assemble medical kits. And then we also have some educational games for children to play to learn more about the plight of children in less fortunate circumstances.
We've been describing the Arthur Mennonite Relief Sale. The chair of that is our guest today, who's also a professor of philosophy, Danny Otto. And I want to thank you for being our guest. Let me just repeat the information for folks who'd like to learn more about the sale. You may call phone number 217-543-3307. You may check a website at www.prairienet.org/Arthur, that's A-R-T-H-U-R, Relief Sale, R-E-L-I-E-F-S-A-L-E. Arthur Relief Sale is all squished together, and you can find that information on the web. Our guest next week on Keeping the Faith will be Father Paul Plouffe. He'll be talking about Mary in church life, Roman Catholic priest. That's August 15 at 5 o'clock here on Keeping the Faith. August 22nd, Joel and Barry Schweitzer will be our guests talking about Jewish education. And we'll be having another Mennonite on August 28th. It'll be too late for the sale, but Pastor Larry Wilson from the First Mennonite Church in Urbana will be our guest talking about current Mennonite faith and life. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. Usually it's a call-in show, and next week we'll be back to our regular format. So I encourage listeners who have questions and comments to call us next week. Thanks again to our guest, Danny Otto. My name is Steve Shoemaker, thanking you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853. Enjoy AM 580 programming on the web. You can listen to our programming streamed live 24 hours a day or check out our archived programs. Selected Focus 580 and Afternoon Magazine interviews, Commodity Week programs, and features from our award-winning news department are available at our website. Just point your web browser to will.uiuc.edu and click on the links. That's will.uiuc.edu.
Have you ever wondered why Homer's Iliad is still so popular?
The Iliad is a real boy's story. It's a perfect story for pre-adolescent boys, I think.
I'm Jim Fleming. We'll talk with writer Thomas Cahill about our enduring fascination with the ancient Greeks. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a low in the mid-60s and south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the mid-80s with southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the evening. The low in the lower 60s with west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.